had never attended a gathering of such formality or grandeur. When the cocktail hour ended, crossing the hallway to the huge dining room where Graham held her famous parties, its paneled walls lit by the glow of tapered candles and bronze sconces, did nothing to make Buffett feel more at home. This setting intimidated even more than the living room. Crystal candlesticks and armorial porcelain gleamed on the round walnut dining tables, although the guests whom Graham had invited outshone the splendor of the surroundings. The room at any given time could be filled with a selection of U.S. presidents, foreign leaders, diplomats, administration officials, congressional members of both parties, senior lawyers in town, and people chosen from her group of perennial friends: Ed Williams, Scotty Reston, Polly Wisner, Roy Evans, Evangeline Bruce, Joseph Alsop, along with people like the Buffetts, who, for one reason or another, suited the occasion or were interesting to her. Buffett found himself seated next to Edmund Muskie's wife, Jane, an obvious dinner partner, since the Buffetts had entertained her husband in Omaha. On his other side was Barbara Bush, whose husband was the U.S. ambassador to the United Nations, but would soon become the chief of the U.S. liaison office in Peking, with the important role of steering the United States through the delicate process of renewing its diplomatic ties with China. Graham pressed a button to signal the kitchen, and waiters began to move around the antique Georgian tables and serve. Warren tried not to gape at the protocol. "Susie's over there sitting next to some senator, and he's trying to make out with her. He's got his hand on her leg and all these things. But me? I'm dying, because I don't know what to talk to these people about." Barbara Bush could not have been nicer. She could see how ill at ease I was. The waiters began to follow an American version of service à la Russe, serving the first course, followed by a fish course, then the main course, all borne on trays from which the diners served themselves. On and on the courses went as wine was poured to the sound of Washington chatter. The waiters added and removed unfamiliar sterling implements like fish knives. As they offered him food that he would never eat and wines that he would never drink, he found the meal increasingly more complex and intimidating. Graham's other guests were relaxed and comfortable, but by the time dessert was served, Buffett was thoroughly cowed. Then came coffee he did not drink. His discomfort increased to terror when, at the end of every evening, Graham stood up and read an articulate, witty, polished, personal, and original toast to her guest of honor that she had obviously put considerable thought into writing, however lacking in confidence her delivery. The guest of honor was supposed to stand and toast his hostess in kind. "I didn't have the nerve to stand up and offer a toast, which you're supposed to do. I blew it totally. I was so uncomfortable. I even thought I might throw up, actually. I could not stand up there in front of half the cabinet and talk. I wasn't up to it." All he wanted to do was escape. Afterward, as he and Susie made their goodbyes, they had the feeling that the Hicks from Nebraska would be the talk of Georgetown long after they left. This senator was still trying to score with Susie as we were leaving, and was so concentrating on explaining how she should come down to the Senate and see his offices as we were leaving that he opened the door to a closet and walked in. That was my introduction to Washington. Yet while it was true that the formal, glittering society that surrounded the powerful Mrs. Graham may have unnerved Buffett and made him ill at ease, he had never been one to hide his enthusiasms. And so it must have soon become obvious to Susie Buffett that her husband wanted more of this world. Chapter 38. Spaghetti Western. Omaha, 1973-1974. By the time he dined with Catherine Graham in 1973, Buffett was no longer just an investor who was buying newspaper stocks. He was becoming a business mogul on a small scale. Berkshire Hathaway and Diversified were his bailiwick. Charlie Munger was the czar of blue-chip stamps. The interlocking ownership of these three companies had tightened the business relationship between Buffett and Munger and resembled the embryo of an empire built by another investor whom Buffett in particular admired, Gurdon W. Wattles. His company, American Manufacturing, was like a Russian doll. Open it, and inside was another company, and another, and another. Mergenthaler Linotype, Crane Company, Electric Autolite. These stocks were all publicly traded because, though Waddles controlled them, he did not own 100% of any of them. From early in his investing career, Buffett admired the Waddles model. He considered how best to profit from the same stocks Waddles was buying. He talked about Waddles all the time to his friends. "The only way to go is coattail riding," he would say. Waddles had this little closed-end investment company called Century Investors, which had to report to the SEC. He did this chain thing where he would be buying stock in a company at a discount, which would be buying stock in another company at a discount, which would be buying stock in another company at a discount. The big company at the end of the thing was Mergenthaler Linotype, which was two-thirds owned by American Manufacturing. In those days, you didn't have to file with the SEC to publicly reveal that you were buying, so nobody knew, and he would just keep buying until he got control. He bought control of Electric Autolite, partly through Mergenthaler, and he was doing the same thing with Crane Company, not the stationery, but the plumbing supply. Somewhere in the chain was Webster Tobacco. They were all cheap, statistically. Everything sold at a discount, and you could just keep buying all of them and make more money every time you made a purchase. Usually I would buy some of all of them. I owned Mergenthaler, I owned Electric Autolite, I owned American Manufacturing. What would cause the value to come out, that was always the question. But you just had a feeling you were with a smart guy, and eventually it would. Early on, he went to see Waddles at his office at White Weldon Company in Boston. I was a little apprehensive and said something like, "Mr. Waddles, I hope I can ask you some questions." And he said, "Shoot." Right away, I had to start thinking of questions. He was very good with me. For 10 or 15 years, I followed him. He was very Graham-like, very Graham-like. Nobody paid any attention to him except me. He was sort of my model as to what I hoped to do for a while. It was so understandable and so obvious and such a sure way of making money. Although it didn't make you huge money necessarily, you knew you were going to make money. What interested Warren about the Waddles model, the way one company could legitimately buy cheap stock in another. You don't have to think of everything, you know? It was Isaac Newton who said, "I've seen a little more of the world than others because I stand on the shoulders of giants." There's nothing wrong with standing on other people's shoulders. Eventually, Waddles had merged his empire into one company, Eltra Corporation, created through the merger of Mergenthaler Linotype and Electric Autolite. This stock was now a favorite of Bill Ruane's because the company's earnings were compounding at 15% a year. The Buffett-Munger companies were beginning to look a little like Eltra before its combination. Berkshire Hathaway was Diversified's largest shareholder and also owned blue chip stock. Each of them also acted as a holding company for businesses that were not traded publicly. Most notably, Blue Chip owned See's Candies, which was so profitable that it more than offset the losses from the rapidly shrinking trading stamp business. Munger now followed up by buying 20% of a near-defunct investment firm, Source Capital, for Blue Chip. "We bought it at a discount from its asset value," says Munger, "and there were two assholes who were the sellers. We had a no-asshole rule very early. Our basic rule has always been that we won't deal with assholes." And so Warren, when he heard about Source Capital, said, "Now I understand the two-asshole exception to the no-asshole rule." 20% is influence, not control. Munger went on the board of Source Capital with a new set of talented managers who were not assholes, Jim Gibson and George Michaelis, and started straightening out its portfolio. Source Capital, however, was small change. Buffett and Munger were both always on the lookout for anything new they could acquire, especially something bigger that would give Blue Chip the kind of boost that See's Candies had. They had found a sleepy West Coast savings and loan company, Wesco Financial. When a broker called Buffett offering some cheap Wesco stock, after a brief conversation with Munger, they grabbed it and bought the shares for Blue Chip stamps. Then Wesco announced that it was going to merge with Financial Corporation of Santa Barbara. Santa Barbara was a hot stock with an aggressive approach that Wall Street liked. Analysts thought Santa Barbara was paying too much for Wesco. Yet Buffett and Munger saw the opposite. They thought Santa Barbara's stock was overpriced and Wesco was handing over its stock too cheap. Buffett went nuts. He read the terms and couldn't believe them. Have they lost their minds? He asked. Founded by the Casper family, Wesco was located in Pasadena, Munger's hometown. It owned Mutual Savings, a savings and loan that had prospered when the GIs came home from the Asian theater during the post-World War II building boom. Even so, Wesco had never exploited its opportunities for growth, but it was extremely profitable because it kept its costs so low. Betty Casper Peters, the only member of the founding family both interested and able to serve on the board, felt that Wesco's managers condescended to her and dismissed her suggestions that they could grow the company. Instead, they used her family's legacy as a ticket to ride at the head of the Rose Bowl parade. Peters, an elegantly dressed, high-cheekboned former art history student, had school-age kids, no business background, and spent much of her time tending the family vineyard in Napa. Now she drove back and forth to Pasadena on Wednesdays to attend board meetings. Running a savings and loan, she found, was hardly a black art. She subscribed to everything relevant she could get her hands on and sat down and read and figured it out. As Peter's frustration grew, she pushed for a merger. She knew the Santa Barbara offer wasn't great, but all of the company's executives were in their mid-40s and they were bright and aggressive. Although they hung around the country club too much for her taste, they were vigorous, acquiring branches and doing things that she thought should be done. Blue Chip already owned 8% of Wesco when the merger was announced. Munger thought that if they kept buying Wesco, it could accumulate enough stock to defeat the Santa Barbara deal. But then he discovered that it would take 50% of the stock, a much higher obstacle. Munger had a greater incentive than Buffett to keep going, since Blue Chip was his partnership's most important investment. He urged going ahead. Buffett thought 50% was too high a threshold and held back. Soon thereafter, Munger went to see Wesco's CEO, Louis Vincenti, and tried to persuade him to abandon the Santa Barbara deal. And Vincenti brushed Munger off like a flake of dandruff. Not an easy thing to do. Munger and Buffett had no intention of launching a competing, hostile bid, however. Further, Munger could not imagine that such a thing might be necessary. He wrote Vincenti, appealing to his higher values. Surely his superior reasoning could bring Vincenti around. It was wrong that Wesco should sell itself too cheap. Vincenti should simply see that. So Munger told Vincenti that he liked Wesco's management and that Vincenti was Buffett and Munger's sort of fellow. He told Vincenti something like, "You're engaged to this other girl, so we can't talk to you. But if you were free, you're the kind of man we would like." Munger's old-fashioned, Ben Franklin-esque sense of ethics and his noblesse oblige notion that gentlemen in business should agree upon the right conduct among themselves must have sounded like Sanskrit to Vincenti. But at least Vincenti did let slip that Betty Peters was the shareholder pushing for the merger. Munger sent Don Koppel, CEO of Blue Chip, down to see Peters. She viewed him as a minion and sent him back empty-handed. So it was time for the big gun. Within 10 minutes of Koppel's departure, Buffett called her. Peters had just finished reading the chapter on him in Jerry Goodman's Super Money, which her husband had given her for Christmas. "Are you the same Warren Buffett that's in Super Money?" she asked. Buffett admitted that he was the man who, according to Jerry Goodman, represented the triumph of straight thinking and high standards over flapdoodle, folly, and flimflam. Peters willingly agreed to meet Buffett with her three children at the TWA Ambassador Lounge at the San Francisco airport 24 hours later. At the meeting, Buffett, with Pepsi in hand, underplayed his talent and record while asking questions in a warm, unthreatening manner. They talked for 3 hours, mostly about Omaha, where Peter's mother had grown up. They talked about politics. Peters, a lifelong Democrat, was pleased by Buffett's views. Finally, he said, with considerable understatement, "Betty, I think I can do better with Wesco than this merger. Inasmuch as you're giving up the company, why don't we give it a try?" Peters was taken with Buffett and thought he might be right about doing better than the fast young men from Santa Barbara. In fact, her concern now became that something might happen to Buffett if she swung her vote to him. He told her he had a partner, however, someone who would be in charge of Berkshire and the Buffett family stock holdings if the proverbial truck mowed him down. On her next trip to Pasadena, Peters sat down to breakfast with Buffett and Munger at the grand old Huntington Hotel, so that she could get to know this mysterious partner. The two of them asked for a meeting with the Wesco board. Peters then did something brave, allowing herself to look capricious in front of the board rather than let the company make a serious mistake. She went to the next board meeting and asked the board to reverse course and meet with Buffett and Munger. The board waved her off, however, and voted at a special meeting to use every effort to complete the merger with Financial Corporation of Santa Barbara. Forgetting who actually owned the company was their mistake. Peters now took Munger and Buffett to meet her brothers to secure their votes. By the time the board met again a week later and reaffirmed their position, Peters had made a decision and, behind the scenes, brought her whole family around to voting against the Santa Barbara deal. "And then my task," says Peters, "was to go back into that little hermetically sealed Pasadena boardroom and tell all these button-down gentlemen, including the management, that we're not going forward with the Santa Barbara savings deal." When she returned to the Spanish-style building, she was thinking about the plaza outside the boardroom windows with its tile-lined fountain. "If the windows had been open," she says, "they would have thrown me out of them. I knew that what was going on in everyone's mind was, my God, is this what happens when you let a hormonal woman on the board?" Wall Street thought so. It sent Wesco's stock nosediving from a high of above $18 to $11 on the news. Wesco's management was old and not very aggressive, one analyst said. Another claimed Santa Barbara was paying too much for Wesco, a sleeping company for years with old management. Another referred to it as garbage. For her courage, Buffett and Munger now felt indebted to Peters. They had also decided they wanted to own Wesco themselves and felt it would be possible to engage Vincenti and win his cooperation. However, by then it must have been apparent that Lou Vincenti would not gamble along behind them like a lamb after its mother. Accordingly, they loosened the purse strings and told their brokers, for once, to bid liberally on the stock. Blue Chip paid $17 for Wesco shares, the price at which they had traded before the deal fell through. "I will admit we were eccentric," says Munger. "We deliberately paid more than we had to, but we felt we'd scuttled the damn merger, and we didn't like taking advantage of it by buying at the market price. We thought it was kind of the right thing to do." Well, nobody could understand that. They thought something must have been dishonorable about doing that. "We really thought we'd make a better impression on Louis Vincenti if we didn't scuttle the merger, then buy the stock cheap. That would look pretty God knows what, and we wanted Louis to be our partner for the long term. We were trying to behave well." By March 1973, Blue Chip owned a quarter of the Wesco stock, and Buffett, who had never stopped buying Blue Chip, continued his drive to get hold of more. The year before, he had exchanged Diversified's Thrifty Mart shares for still more Blue Chip stock. Including the 13% of Blue Chip he owned outright, as well as his share of the stock owned by Berkshire and Diversified, which owned another 35%, Buffett was now effectively the largest Blue Chip shareholder. Blue Chip began to formally tender for Wesco's shares, this time paying $15 a share in cash, until it owned more than half. Within weeks, Munger outlined for Lou Vincenti a vision for the company that, not surprisingly, resembled the way Buffett thought about Berkshire Hathaway and Diversified. Wesco, with Munger as chairman, would be another new doll among the rest, this one residing inside Blue Chip. Then, no sooner had Blue Chip bought the majority of Wesco than the whole stock market fell apart. Buffett's stake in the Washington Post lost a quarter of its value. Ordinarily, he would have bought more. However, he had promised Graham that he wouldn't. Instead, he recommended it to his friends. So instead of buying more Post stock, Buffett, who had always believed in concentration, looked for new opportunities and began filling his basket faster than an Easter egg hunt with huge quantities of a handful of other stocks. National Presto, maker of pressure cookers and popcorn poppers, and a huge chunk of Vornado Realty Trust, which put him on its board. Buffett had set a legacy of shareholders at Berkshire Hathaway who understood his investing approach and would never question his judgment. Thus, he had earned the luxury of ignoring Mr. Market, which had marked down the value of his portfolio to a fire sale price. Others were not so lucky. Bill Ruane's Sequoia Fund was headed for a terrible year, and Ruane's main financial backer, Bob Mallett, was apparently unhappy. Mallett knew Ruane from Harvard, and they had shared an apartment when Ruane was working at Kidder Peabody in New York. But Mallett was sold on Buffett's approach and track record. He asked for Buffett's help with the pension fund of FMC Corporation, the company he now headed. So Buffett went to San Diego and spent several days interviewing investment managers and explaining his thinking to FMC's investment people. In the process, he converted them to Grahamites with what would eventually become powerful results. At first, he said no to the request of managing the portfolio himself, then eventually agreed to manage a portion. Along with his acceptance, however, he gave a warning. FMC would come last among his priorities, after Berkshire and Diversified, and Warren and Susie Buffett. The canny Mallett jumped at the opportunity anyway, not mistaking the larger point. That Buffett was willing to do it at all meant that he would do it well. Between his duties at FMC, Vernado, Blue Chip, and Wesco, and regular trips to New York, Buffett was now traveling much of the time. He was also busy courting Katherine Graham and had made such a good impression on her that she began to call him for advice. Susie made the rounds of Omaha, busy with the board of the Urban League, still giving out her scholarships, and taking on her latest crusade, the Future Central Committee, which was trying to save her alma mater, Central High School, from forced busing. As 1973 progressed, even Hamilton the dog must have noticed the silence and emptiness descending on the Buffett's crazy, noisy home. Howie was 275 miles away from Omaha at Augustana College. Susie Jr., unhappy with Lincoln, had transferred to the University of California, Irvine, where she was majoring in criminal justice. Peter, the child who had never required attention, was now a sophomore in high school. Thinking of moving to California, Susie had taken him to look at schools in Orange County. They stayed in Omaha, however, and now Peter spent much of his time in the basement, where Susie, who had gotten him interested in photography, had built him a dark room. Often now, Susie stayed up late at night alone, listening to music that transported her to some different place. She loved the jazz guitar of Wes Montgomery and great soul music like the Temptations, who sang of a world in which it was men who felt all the longing. She read books like I Know Why the Caged Bird Sings, Maya Angelou's autobiographical account of overcoming the forces of racism, sexual abuse, and repression that made her early years a prison. The idea of being confined in a place not of your choosing ran deep for her, Peter says, not surprising after her childhood shut away in a sick room and growing up with a sister who was disciplined by being locked in a closet. Susie longed for romance, but now knew that she and Milt were never going to get married. Nevertheless, she could not bring herself to give up her connection to Milt. She was also spending more time with her tennis crowd of younger people at Dewey Park. One, John McCabe, a coach with a subdued personality, a sadness somewhat like her own, and a certain fragility, resembled most of her other lonely hearts, but she seemed particularly drawn to him. Now that Susie had reasons to be away from the house most of the time, the hubbub began to dim. Her hangers-on hung out with Susie elsewhere, and the rhythm of the house slowed from its all-day carnival atmosphere. Peter, never much attuned to his parents' lives, noticed only the growing silence, not its cause. When he got home from school, he petted Hamilton, made something for himself for dinner, and headed downstairs to the darkroom. Warren's conception of his marriage had never changed, even though the marriage itself was changing inexorably. When he was home, Susie still seemed just as devoted to him as ever. He saw how active and busy she was and wanted her to be fulfilled, as long as she continued to take care of him, which he assumed was fulfilling to her. As far as he knew, the balancing act that had always worked for them still did. The retired Warren was investing at full throttle ahead in late 1973 in the midst of a market swoon. Between Cap Cities and the Washington Post and his growing friendship with Kay Graham, his interest in media over the past few years had permutated into a deep understanding of the subject at all levels. One night at dinner in Laguna Beach, he and Carol Loomis started strafing Buffett's friend Dick Holland, who worked in advertising, with questions about the advertising business. Whenever he did that, Holland recalls, I always knew something was cooking. The four of them talked business while Susie and Mary Holland, in Perda, entertained themselves. Sure enough, as a secondary way to play media, Buffett got on the phone to his trader and plunked down almost $3 million for the stocks of advertising agencies Interpublic, J. Walter Thompson, and Ogilvy & Mather, stocks so distressed he paid less than 3 times their earnings. While he was buying, however, most of the stocks that Buffett had accumulated were faltering. As 1974 began, stocks for which he had paid $50 million had lost a quarter of their value. Berkshire, too, started to slide, down to $64 per share. Some of the former partners who had kept the stock began to worry about whether they had made a mistake. Buffett saw it just the opposite way. He wanted to buy more Berkshire and Blue Chip, but I'd run out of gas. I had used all the $16 million of cash I got out of the partnership to buy stock in Berkshire and Blue Chip, so all of a sudden I woke up one day and had no money at all. I was getting $50,000 a year salary from Berkshire Hathaway and some fees from FMC, but I had to start my personal net worth over again from zero. He was now very, very rich, but cash poor. The companies he controlled, especially Berkshire Hathaway, had cash to buy stocks, however. To move some of Berkshire's money to Diversified, Buffett set up a reinsurance company, a company that insures other insurers, in Diversified. This company, Reinsurance Corporation of Nebraska, agreed to take part of National Indemnity's business, receiving premiums and covering losses. Because National Indemnity was so profitable and generated so much float, premiums paid ahead of claims, i.e., cash, sending part of its business to Diversified was like sending a pipeline into a river of money. As time passed, it would give Diversified millions more dollars to invest. Buffett began to buy stocks for Diversified. Principally, he followed the Wattles model and bought stock in Blue Chip and Berkshire Hathaway. Soon, Diversified owned 10% of Berkshire. It was almost as though Berkshire was buying back its own stock, but not quite. Diversified's owners and Berkshire's weren't the same. Buffett still forbade his friends to buy Berkshire, whereas he, Munger, and Gottesman were partners in Diversified. At the time, even though the three did each other business favors and swapped stock ideas on occasion, their interests didn't necessarily align. Asked later under oath if he was Buffett's alter ego, Munger said no. He acknowledged similar mannerisms and ways of speech, but, I've never chosen a role of being a junior partner, he said. I like the idea of having a sphere of activity of my own. On one occasion, Munger said, he had found a block of Blue Chip stock that he and Gottesman wanted to buy for Diversified. Buffett wanted to take the block away from them and buy it for Berkshire Hathaway. After a discussion, clearly about who needed it more, the combined strength of Munger and Gottesman had somehow overpowered Buffett, and Diversified got the stock. At least that way they kept a little share. Still, Buffett did own 43% of Diversified, so its purchases of Berkshire had added almost 5% to his personal ownership. Buying through Diversified was particularly attractive in that it tended not to ratchet up Berkshire's stock price. Hardly anybody was paying attention. But why did he want it at all? Berkshire was not worth more than $40 as a business. You couldn't have sold the textile mills and insurance business for more. And half the money was in a lousy business. I mean a really lousy business. $20 a share of the $40. And I didn't know what I was going to do. I literally didn't. I mean, I was rich enough already. But in effect, I was betting that I could do something. I was betting on myself. And though it sounds egotistical, anybody who might have thought it was worth more than $40 was purely paying for me, because the company was not worth that. He didn't know what he was going to do, except invest. Vern McKenzie, who had returned from New Bedford to become Berkshire's controller, thought that, to Buffett, it simply looked like an interesting game. All he was doing was solidifying his control. That he was, and doing so in the manner in which he always approached investing, as a collector, one who bought in secrecy to avoid tipping off other bargain hunters. But as the chairman of Berkshire Hathaway and Diversified, He was once again mostly buying from sellers who had been his former partners. Although perfectly legal, it was not exactly sporting conduct. But their willingness to sell, in his mind, ended his special obligation to them. Buffett had also been buying blue-chip stamps all along, though so far, blue-chip had remained primarily Munger's province. It owned the best of the businesses, however, namely See's. Now Buffett began to pursue blue-chip stock like a great white shark after a well-fed seal. Since he had far greater financial resources, Buffett's ownership percentage of blue-chip quickly surpassed the combined interest of his partners in that stock, Munger and Rick Guerin, Munger's associate from the Pacific Coast Stock Exchange, who now ran an investment partnership of his own. Buffett bought blue chip wherever he could get it. He bought from blue chip's management and from other directors. One of these, Z. Wayne Griffin, asked $10.25 to Buffett's bid of $10. Reaching an impasse on the phone, Buffett recalls that Griffin suggested they flip a coin. He was taken aback by Griffin's willingness to do this, sight unseen. From that fact alone, Buffett realized not only that Griffin trusted him, but that he had already buffeted himself. Griffin called it heads. Obviously, if he made such a bet, he was willing to take the $10, which he did. Buffett's accumulation of all these stocks, however, differed from his buying in the era of cheap cigar butts. Two large question marks hung over Blue Chip, Diversified, and Berkshire. As Buffett solidified control, all that money pouring into both Berkshire and Diversified from the insurance business would have to be put to good use, and the bet on Blue Chip's legal problems would have to work out. By year-end 1973, Blue Chip had settled 11 lawsuits. All that remained was the Justice Department's ruling that it divest one-third of its business. That would not be easy because the president's freeze on food prices is another knee in the groin for us, Don Koppel wrote. The grocers are screaming, predicting huge losses, bankruptcy in some cases. Inflation had run rampant. President Nixon had frozen prices on commodities to try to halt it, and commerce had entered a new era of trying to match rising costs to frozen consumer prices. The stamp business was dead, but Buffett, the implacable acquirer, had his stock. After this series of trading gyrations, Blue Chip had waddled its way into the set of Russian dolls. It was the same principle, Buffett says. Including all the pockets in which he had bought shares indirectly, he owned more than 40% of Berkshire and more than 25% of Blue Chip stamps. Even though these stocks traded at depressed prices, he could fund more deals and buy more stocks because all of the dolls had their own self-charging batteries. Float. Cash that could be invested in advance of paying claims. This innovation dramatically improved the deal. The operating businesses themselves had also improved since the dismal days of windmills and fire maps. Along with See's, Berkshire owned not only the whopping float generator National Indemnity, but also a clutch of little insurance companies that Buffett hoped would eventually turn into small powerhouses, even though he was struggling to whip them into shape. Meanwhile, the dead weight of Hochschild Cone had disappeared, and Buffett kept shrinking the textile mills. But in the bigger picture, what Berkshire, Diversified, and Blue Chip really possessed were two things. The first was the homeostatic business model, the idea of grafting float onto a holding company so that it could respond internally to the changing environment. The second was the power of compounding, as float and investments doubled and redoubled over time. The novelty and strength of Buffett's model cannot be overstated. Nothing else like it existed or would for years to come. That was the golden period of textbook capital allocation, he says. The timing was stupendous. Capital from the insurance companies was pouring into Berkshire and DRC at the same time that the market was collapsing, the environment that Buffett liked best. While he had not yet decided exactly what to do with the collective enterprise he had built by the end of 1974, of two things he was certain. One was the business model's power, and the other was his skill in using it. Above all, he had confidence in himself. Always, he says. Always. Chapter 39. The Giant. Omaha and Los Angeles, 1973 to 1976. Howard Buffett was one of those rare people who prospered in the aftermath of the 1929 stock market crash. Now his sun's star was rising during the second great crash of the century. But the world had changed. Stardom, even in business, now meant fame. Buffett had closed his partnership during a media explosion in the United States, in which cable had transformed television, newspaper companies were going public, and advertising was still in a golden age of selling to a monolithic audience in which virtually the whole nation sat down together on Tuesday nights and watched Happy Days. Buffett had entered the media world as an investor drawn to the business by a natural affinity. But as he embarked on a new post-partnership phase of life, through the publicity he got from the Forbes story in 1969 and then from the Supermoney profile, he began to enjoy the fruit of the discreet use of profile-raising press. Now he was a subject of media interest, not just a media investor, and no less a personage than Katharine Graham was paying him attention and taking him seriously, which had brought him into the orbit of one of the most important newspapers in the United States. As was her habit with powerful men, Graham reached out to him for help. Buffett needed little encouragement. The first time she was going to speak to the New York Society of Security Analysts, I went over there to her apartment in New York on a Sunday morning to help her write her speech. She was a basket case. She was terrified that all these men were going to be there and she was going to have to stand up in front of them. Public speaking was something that was very hard for her always. The funny thing is, she had a great sense of humor. She was smart, but she tended to freeze in front of a crowd, particularly if she thought they were going to question her about numbers. As Robert Redford had said in an interview after first meeting her to discuss the Watergate movie All the President's Men, Graham had a tight-jawed, blue-blooded quality that demanded that her privacy not be invaded. Why, therefore, Redford asked himself, did she keep making speeches and accepting awards, particularly since it terrified her to do it? Buffett sat down in the living room of Graham's large apartment, situated on an upper floor of the modern UN Plaza, overlooking New York City's East River. Surrounded by Asian art and antiques from Agnes Meyer's collection, they started to work. She kept imagining these questions they were going to ask, like, how much are you paying for your newsprint per ton? She thought it was a quiz, and I said, it doesn't make any difference. You're paying what other people are paying for newsprint, so what? But that was a big thing. She was just convinced. I kept trying to get her away from trying to remember facts, just have a theme. Graham wanted to say that good journalism makes good profits. Buffett snorted to himself over this notion and refocused her. You know, good journalism is not inconsistent with good profits, or something like that. The hell with all the other stuff. I just tried to convince her that she was a hell of a lot smarter than all those dumb males that were out there. That's what really sort of bonded us initially. In an ironic turnabout, Buffett became Kay Graham's personal Dale Carnegie instructor. He, of all people, could sympathize with someone who tended to freeze in front of a crowd. Moreover, thanks to Susie's gentle tutelage over the years, he had learned a subtler way of dealing with people. He knew how to anticipate their reactions and to phrase things in a non-threatening way. His letters, which had always been self-conscious, were now more deftly worded and empathetic. He had learned to listen and show interest in other people and to converse on topics other than stocks. It helped that he was genuinely fascinated by Graham. After they finished preparing and rehearsing, Graham said she was going to a party at the Agnelli's that night. You might find the sightseeing entertaining, she said. Why don't you come with me? Buffett always stressed how uncomfortable and out of place he felt at glamorous events and how uninterested he was in attending them. So he told Graham that, yes, he would go. That evening he left his room at the Plaza to pick up Graham and ride to the Upper East Side. We were this very improbable couple, her mid-50s, me early-40s, and we got to this apartment, which was more than an apartment. It was like a triplex. It was huge. And everybody was bowing and scraping to Kay. There was every character from the party scene in the film La Dolce Vita. I was the required walk-on, the potted plant. You wanted it to go in slow motion so you could see everything. Gianni Agnelli, the head of Fiat, and his wife Morella weren't there. It was almost like a costume party, except it wasn't. Buffett returned to Omaha afterward, having seen a new side of Graham. As he continued getting to know her on a personal level, he saw her as a bundle of paradoxes. Fearful but willful, patrician but democratic, wounded by the people she cared most about. He was surprised how much she still talked about her former husband a decade after his suicide. When you first met her, she would often get off on the subject of Phil very quickly, almost like Charlie getting off on a subject. And she described him in terms that were sort of hard to believe, considering how badly he treated her. But after I got to know her better, she told me everything about him and the relationship. She had found it impossible to conceive of herself as being in the same league as him. She felt she was a fraud, almost, even pretending to be in the same room with him. They used to hang out a lot with the Kennedys, and she just felt that she shouldn't be there. Anything he said was funny, anything he did was right. When he used to chop up the children right in front of her, she wouldn't stop him. I mean, the whole thing. That he and Graham, who showed the after effects of an upbringing by a cruel, neglectful mother and years of abuse by a sadistic husband with untreated bipolar disorder, would be mutually attracted, seems almost a foregone conclusion given Buffett's own childhood experiences. He knew how to behave around her in a way that wasn't threatening. By the spring of 1974, she began to switch her allegiance from her other advisors to him. In turn, he seized the chance to tutor the CEO of the Washington Post Company about business as if he had been waiting to play Pygmalion all his life, his very own Eliza Doolittle. More patient than Henry Higgins, he coached her gently and sent helpful, interesting articles to Kay and to her son Don. As Buffett's influence grew stronger, Graham noticed that the words, "Warren says," brought shudders from some of her board members. But Buffett himself was hoping to be invited onto that board. When Tom Murphy had approached him to join the Cap Cities board, Buffett told him no, he was holding out for the post. Murphy dutifully spilled this news to Graham, who felt dense for not having figured it out herself. Susie thought that instead of taking on more business responsibilities, her husband should sell some of their stock and use it for a higher cause. Riding with him in a taxi in Washington, D.C., she pointed out philanthropist Stuart Mott, who was running the Stuart R. Mott Charitable Trust, which gave money to peace, arms control, and population and family planning causes. The Buffetts were now richer than Mott, who had started with $25 million. "Why don't you quit?" Susie said. "Stuart Mott is doing all these other things now, and he doesn't have to work every day." But Warren was incapable of quitting. He fell back on his philosophy that $50 million today would be worth $500 million someday. Nonetheless, he was not entirely disengaged from his family, nor insensitive to his wife. He had picked up some vibrations from Susie, a sense that she wanted more from her life. With Peter moving along in high school, Warren told her, "Susie, you're like someone who has lost his job after 23 years. Now what are you going to do?" "The answer," she said, "was sing." Her nephew Billy Rogers had made her some instrumental guitar tracks so that she could tape herself and listen to her performances. Rogers had been playing jazz guitar at Mr. Toad's, Spaghetti Works, and other clubs in Omaha, and along with him, Susie was now a familiar face in the local music scene. But when she first started practicing, "I was scared, really scared," she said. "I was bad." The last time she had performed in public was 10 years before at a charity benefit at Central High. So she got coaching and worked on contemporary love songs and ballads. Susie first debuted as a chanteuse that July before a friendly audience at a private party at Emerald Bay. "People seemed to like it pretty well," she said, and it thrilled her husband to see his friends applauding his wife's talent. While the Buffetts were in Emerald Bay that summer, Warren invited Graham for a visit in connection with a trip she was making to speak to an analysts' meeting in Los Angeles. Sensing that Graham was going to talk to him about joining the Post board, Buffett had been dancing around his office at Kiewit Plaza for days ahead of time, happy and excited as a kid on Christmas Eve. The Buffett's house at Emerald Bay, down a steep driveway set well back from the beach, still had the feeling of a modest rental house. It lacked most of the personal touches that spoke of a family. Warren had no sense of what kind of impression the place might make on Graham, who owned several enormous, impeccably decorated and maintained mansions, including the farm at Glen Welby and a vast shingle-style waterfront estate on Martha's Vineyard. Apparently, however, he must have impressed upon his wife that they would have to make an unusual effort for Graham. The first morning after Kay arrived, Susie rose at an unheard-of hour and feigned domesticity. She cooked a full breakfast for the three of them, which both of the Buffetts pretended to eat. Her husband spent the rest of the day wrapped up in Graham, talking to her about newspapers, journalism, politics, and bringing up every opportunity for her to invite him on the board. At some point, he put down his newspapers, donned a bathing suit purchased specially for the occasion, picked up a brand new beach umbrella bought in Graham's honor, and left the house with Graham to walk the 100 or so yards down a steep path to the shore to join the family. Previously, his attitude toward the ocean had been, "I think having the ocean nearby is an attractive feature, and fun to listen to at night, and all that kind of stuff. But actually getting in it? I feel I'll save that for my old age." But now, after sitting on the sand for a bit, looking at the water, he waded gamely into the Pacific. By all reports, Susie and the Buffett kids went into convulsions of laughter at the odd sight. What Susie thought about this extraordinary gesture is not known, but Warren's explanation of it is on record. "Only for Kay," he says. "Only for Kay." On Sunday morning, they dropped their company manners, and Susie sleepwalked through cooking bacon and eggs for Graham, eating nothing herself, while Warren sat nearby spooning chocolate Ovaltine from a jar. After breakfast, he and Graham resumed their tete-a-tete. At some point, Graham told him that she wanted him to join her board, but was waiting for the right time. She knew that some of her board members, such as Andre Meyer, would not welcome Buffett. But he asked, "When is the right time?" thus forcing her to make up her mind. And so, in short order, it was done. They agreed that Buffett would join the board of the Washington Post Company. He was elated. That afternoon, Buffett left his family at Emerald Bay and drove Graham to the Los Angeles airport. "On the way, all of a sudden, she looked at me like a three-year-old kid. Her voice changed and her eyes, and she said, basically pleading, 'Just be gentle with me. Please don't ever assault me.' I learned later that Phil and some people at the paper, to get their own ends or for sheer enjoyment, would push her buttons just to watch her fall apart. It was cruel on the part of Phil. It was manipulative on the part of the rest. It was very easy to do. The buttons still worked." At summer's end, on September 11, 1974, Buffett officially joined the board, which catapulted him from a star investment manager from Omaha to official advisor at one of the most important media companies in the world. Even at that first meeting, he could see that Graham had a habit of pleading with the board for help. Buffett thought, "This won't do. You can't put yourself in that position as a CEO." But he didn't yet know her well enough to say anything. Instead, he educated himself about the Post board, which was full of many prominent and influential people, and began to tiptoe his way through the powerful, jockeying men who were used to dominating Graham. He was a quiet board member, however, and used his skills behind the scenes. Buffett, at the time, was preoccupied with far more than just Kay Graham and the Washington Post. The market, which investors had expected to rally in 1974, instead was in the full throes of collapse. Pension fund managers had cut back their stock purchases by more than 80%. Berkshire's own portfolio looked as though someone had given it a severe hedge trimming, shearing off nearly one-third in the second great crash, the kind that comes along only a few times in a century. Munger had kept his partnership open after Buffett had shuttered his. Now its value was plunging. His performance had always been more volatile, in both directions, than the markets. For the past couple of years, he had managed decent, though unspectacular, returns. But by 1974, Munger found himself in trouble, his partners losing nearly half of their money. Like Ben Graham half a century earlier, he felt obliged to make their money back. If you're put together properly, you have a fiduciary gene like Warren and me, he says, and if you've told people, I think I can get you extraordinary results, then you really hate the idea of not delivering for them. As for himself, certainly the quoted value of my capital went down. I didn't like it, but just think about how many years could go by. What difference does it make at the end whether I have X dollars or X minus Y? The only thing that bothered me was that I knew how hard it was on the partners. That was what killed me, the fiduciary aspect of my position. Munger still had about 28 limited partners, including some family trusts. To earn back losses of half his capital, he would have to more than double the remaining stake. The value of blue chip stamps would have a significant bearing on whether he could accomplish that. Bill Ruane's Sequoia Fund was also in trouble. It had started with $50 million from Buffett's former partners and invested its money well by taking large positions in undervalued stocks like Tom Murphy's Capital Cities Communications. This was not the kind of stock that money managers who had piled into glamour television and electronic stocks a few years earlier were buying now. They had galloped, all at the same time, straight the other way, into the arms of the Nifty 50, a small group of the largest, best-known companies. In this business, Ruane said, you have the innovators, the imitators, and the swarming incompetents. The imitators and the swarming incompetents were now at the wheel, and the stocks that Ruane and his partner Rick Cunniff had bought in 1970 had been cut in half. Compounding their problems, they had bought a seat on the New York Stock Exchange just before prices for seats fell over a cliff. The timing of Sequoia's opening was obviously inauspicious. Ruane had agreed to start up just as Buffett was shutting down due to lack of opportunities. Sequoia had underperformed the market every year, cumulatively by a dramatic amount. The Sequoia Fund's worst year yet was 1973. It had lost 25% compared to the market's loss of 15%. It was on its way to another terrible year in 1974. Ruane's largest backer, Bob Mallett, was incensed. He was already known as a ball-buster around the halls of Ruane Cunniff for his habit of calling to complain about minor discrepancies in his family's accounts. Now, he berated Ruane for buying a seat on the exchange and for his poor performance with such persistence that Ruane feared he would pull his capital out of the firm. Buffett, however, remained serene in the knowledge that Mr. Market's opinion of a stock's price at any time had no bearing on its intrinsic value. He knew which stocks Ruane and his partners had bought and was confident that they had made good decisions. If not exactly an ego booster because of the snooty staff, Buffett's 1969 meeting of the Grahamites at the Colony Club had at least provided mutual support in a challenging market. Since then, Buffett had named them the Graham Group. Ed Anderson had planned the third outing in Williamsburg, Charlie Munger the fourth in Carmel, California. In 1971, Buffett made the meetings biennial. Out of loyalty, he let Ruane invite Mallett, a favor normally verboten, and Mallett and his wife Ibby became members for the next meeting in Sun Valley in 1973, planned by Rick Guerin. Mallett, mightily impressed by the whole affair, stayed in Ruane's fold, even though his complaints continued at a frequency and volume that still made Ruane fear his defection. By the end of 1974, however, while the market was down by more than 25%, the Sequoia Fund had at least managed to produce a smaller loss than the markets. Nonetheless, the market's cumulative toll on the Sequoia Fund was such that Henry Brandt and John Loomis, Carol's husband, both of whom had gone to work there, feared the worst and cast off from what seemed a sinking ship. Forbes captured Buffett's attitude in an interview that November, which opened with a juicy quote. Asked how he felt about the market, like an oversexed man in a harem, Buffett replied, this is the time to start investing. He went on to say, this is the first time I can remember that you could buy Phil Fisher, growth, stocks, at Ben Graham, cigar butt, prices. He felt this was the most significant statement that he could make, but Forbes didn't include it. A general audience wouldn't understand the references to Fisher and Graham. When Forbes asked for specific stock ideas, instead of mentioning what he was buying or had bought, Buffett turned impish and did one of his little experiments to see how well the reporter had researched him via other Forbes articles. "A water company is pretty simple," he said, adding that Blue Chip owned 5% of San Jose Water Works. The reporter took the bait. San Jose Water Works went in the story with no reference to the earlier piece insinuating he'd bought it using insider information. But despite his enthusiasm for the market so far in 1974, he had invested at a trickle and mostly moved money around into Studebaker Worthington, Handy and Harmon, Hart Hanks Newspapers, and Multimedia Incorporated, and added to his Coldwell Banker position. He bumped up a few of his other shareholdings by 10 or 20%. He had also bought 100,000 shares of Blue Chip from Rick Guerin. "He sold me at $5 because he was getting squeezed," Buffett says. "That was a brutal period." The harem comment had a double meaning. While it was indeed the time to start investing, Buffett, for the most part, could look but not touch. One of National Indemnity's business partners, an aviation broker, had run amok, selling money-losing aviation insurance policies. The company had tried to stop the agent by revoking its authority, but for several months was unable to shut it down. The accounting records were a shambles, and the losses were unclear. National Indemnity had no idea how high the bill for the Omni affair would run, but worst-case estimates ran as high as tens of millions of dollars. The hope was that they were much less, because National Indemnity did not have tens of millions. Buffett was sweating. Within a couple of months, by early 1975, his problems compounded monumentally. Chuck Rickershauser, a partner from Munger's law firm, now renamed Munger, Tolles, and Rickershauser, called him and Munger to say that the Securities and Exchange Commission was considering pressing charges against them for violating securities laws. What had seemed like a brewing but manageable problem had now exploded into a full-scale emergency. Rickershauser had first started doing legal work for Buffett and Munger during the Sees transaction. More recently, he had been fighting a rearguard action ever since an SEC staff lawyer had called him and said he had some questions. Under the assumption that the matter was routine, Rickershauser had directed the man to Vern McKenzie, Berkshire's controller. When McKenzie's phone rang in Nebraska, he picked it up to find the head of the SEC's enforcement division, Stanley Sporkin, the much-feared tough cop of the business world, on the other end of the line. Sporkin looked as though he spent his evenings hunched, droopy-eyed under a desk lamp, personally drafting the charges against large corporations that, for the first time in American history, had frightened a remarkable number of them into settling with the SEC without ever setting foot in court. On the phone, he interrogated McKenzie on a wide range of subjects, from Wesco to Blue Chip to Berkshire and beyond. His tone was not friendly, but this, McKenzie had assumed, was simply his modus operandi. On the other hand, McKenzie did get the impression that Sporkin thought if you were rich, you must have done something wrong. When Rickershauser heard that Sporkin, rather than a staff lawyer, had personally called and grilled McKenzie at length, he nearly had a heart attack. Sporkin's batting average had made his jowly profile among the most recognizable in American business. In a practical sense, he had more power than his boss, the chairman of the SEC. What seemed to have drawn the SEC's attention was a project of nearly 2 years in which Buffett and Munger were trying to delicately untangle the many strands of spaghetti that connected the several companies they owned. Their first step had been to try to merge Diversified, the least essential piece, into Berkshire Hathaway. By 1973, Diversified had become little more than a vehicle for buying Berkshire and Blue Chip stock. But the Securities and Exchange Commission, whose approval was required, had delayed the Diversified deal. Munger had told Buffett that this was not anything serious. He directed Rickershauser to invite anyone in the SEC who had questions to call him directly, if this will expedite his work and clearance of our papers. Instead, over the next 18 months, the SEC staff seemed to have nosed around looking at Blue Chip stamps and other investments. It concluded that Buffett and Munger had smashed up the Wesco-Santa Barbara deal deliberately by offering a high price for a quarter of the stock for the purpose of taking over the rest. At least, that must have been how it looked to Santa Barbara, for it had apparently turned in Blue Chip to the SEC. For the first time, they all realized that Blue Chip was in trouble. No sooner had Buffett achieved the glory of joining the Post board than his and Munger's need for legal services was about to grow with stunning rapidity. Rickershauser, who already knew what it was like to work with Buffett, had once explained to a colleague that the sun is nice and warm, but you don't want to get too close to it. He would spend the next couple of years testing what could be called Rickershauser's law of thermodynamics. In February 1975, the SEC issued subpoenas and launched a full-blown investigation of Blue Chip's purchase of Wesco. In the matter of Blue Chip stamps, Berkshire Hathaway Incorporated, Warren Buffett, HO 784, the commission staff speculated that Buffett and Munger had committed fraud. Blue Chip, Berkshire, Buffett, singly or in concert with others, may have engaged in acts which have, directly or indirectly, operated as a device, scheme, or artifice to defraud, or included an untrue statement of a material fact or omitted. The commission's lawyers zeroed in on a theory that Blue Chip had planned from the beginning to take over Wesco Financial, but had not disclosed that fact. That Blue Chip's purchases of stock after the Santa Barbara deal dissolved must have been tender offers that were never registered with the SEC. This latter charge was most serious, and carried with it the risk that the SEC would file, with great fanfare and publicity, civil fraud charges not only against Blue Chip, but also against Buffett and Munger personally. In considering action against a target, Sporkin had a choice. He could prosecute or settle. A settlement was a way of allowing the target to say sorry without having to officially admit guilt. It neither consented to nor denied the charge of fraud, but agreed to accept a penalty. And in agreeing to a settlement, the SEC could also choose whether to name the individuals involved or simply to make a deal with the company itself without naming anybody. Being named in a settlement might not be the literal end of someone's career, but there would be no elephant bumping afterward. Having so recently been elevated into the high and mighty through super money and Forbes and the board of the Washington Post, Buffett began to fight desperately to save his reputation. Instead, the investigation widened. Under subpoena, Buffett had to open his files, which, naturally, represented a huge and comprehensive collection of documents, just as huge and comprehensive as everything he had ever collected. In violation of his cherished privacy, lawyers from Munger Tolles sifted out trade tickets, information about recent stock purchases, memos to bankers, letters to See's Candies, notes to Vern McKenzie at the textile mill, and the like, and shipped them off to investigators in Washington, D.C. Buffett felt persecuted. He and Munger were being chased in a nightmare by a huge lumbering giant. To survive, they would have to outrun it. Letters flew back and forth like shuttlecocks between Munger Tolles and the SEC. Buffett maintained a veneer of calm, but his back problems were plaguing him. Munger did not hide his agitation. By March 1975, the investigation had wound its way to a command performance at the SEC. Betty Peters was hauled in. "Is your lawyer here?" they asked. "No." "Do I need a lawyer?" she replied. "Well, everybody comes with a lawyer," they told her. "Don't you just want to know what happened?" she asked. They interviewed Peters without a lawyer. Munger was summoned. For 2 days, also unaccompanied, for what additional legal counsel could Charles T. Munger possibly need, he tried to defend Blue Chip against the charge that it was trying to bust up the Santa Barbara merger and to explain why Blue Chip had paid more than was strictly necessary for Wesco stock. Yes, Blue Chip had thought about getting control, he said, but those plans were only remote and contingent until the Santa Barbara merger blew up. This discussion became somewhat circular given his and Buffett's role in talking to Vincenti and their admitted wooing of Betty Peters and the Casper family's votes. Munger had a regrettable tendency to interrupt and lecture the SEC staff lawyer, Larry Seidman. "We wanted to look very fair and equitable to Lou Vincenti and Betty Peters," he said. But the SEC lawyers had never met the intractable Lou Vincenti. They could not possibly understand. "What about your Blue Chip shareholders?" Seidman asked. Seidman saw no reason for Blue Chip to be so generous to Wesco shareholders. Wesco's stock by then was largely in the hands of arbitragers. These were people who had bought Wesco stock knowing it would rise to the price that Santa Barbara had offered once the deal closed. They partly hedged their bets by shorting Santa Barbara stock, much as Graham Newman had once bought Rockwood stock in exchange for cocoa bean warehouse receipts. But when the Wesco deal blew up, it was as if the price of cocoa beans had collapsed. Why do the Arbs a favor by propping up the price? Munger reached for his ultimate weapon, Benjamin Franklin. We didn't feel our obligation to the shareholders was inconsistent with leaning over backward to be fair. We have that Ben Franklin idea that the honest policy is the best policy. It had a sort of shoddy mental image to us to try to reduce the price. Sideman seemed a little baffled by this argument, and even Munger admitted that the details of what had been done did not look good. He begged Sideman to look at the big picture. As you look at the overall records, we go way beyond any legal requirement in trying to be fair with people to observe the niceties of fair dealing. I simply hope that you will reach the conclusion that this averages out as not an appropriate case for any sort of prosecution. If there's any defect at all, it's not intentional. When Buffett appeared, they asked him why he and Munger hadn't let Wesco go into the tank so they could buy it cheap. I think the general business reputation of Blue Chip would not have been as good, Buffett said. I think someone might have been sore about it. But why should he care? Because, said Buffett, it was important how Wesco management feels about us. You can say, well, we own the controlling interest, so it doesn't make any difference. But Lou Vincenti doesn't really need to work for us. If he felt that we were, you know, slobs or something, it just wouldn't work. Now Buffett, who, like Munger, startled the enforcement lawyers by showing up alone, made himself helpful, venturing back to Washington several times, patiently explaining how Blue Chip worked, expounding on his investment philosophies, and talking about his childhood years in Washington. He made a favorable impression on Sideman, but not on the senior SEC staff lawyer who was in charge of the investigation, and who was known as a tiger whose motto was, "They shall not pass." He found these arguments unconvincing. The senior investigator's attitude was that nobody who did anything close to the line would ever get by him. The SEC staff kept delving. It seemed fascinated by the intricacies and complications of Buffett's empire. It even started looking into whether he had traded on inside information about San Jose Water Works. The staff started kicking around Source Capital, the closed-end investment fund that Munger had bought a 20% interest in as a cigar butt and helped turn around. By then, the stock market had recovered. Ruane Sequoia Fund had made a huge comeback in 1975, up almost 62% compared to 37% for the market. Munger had just about made back his partner's money, with a 73% gain in 1975. He took no fees for himself and was winding his partnership down. Explaining why their convoluted empire made sense based on the cheap prices paid for stocks at the time grew harder as the market recovered. The investigation kept growing hairy legs like a tarantula. Rickershauser had been studying a chart that showed all of Buffett and Munger's complex financial interests. Buffett sat at the center, buying Blue Chip, Diversified, and Berkshire, waddling them into so many pockets that it made Rickershauser shudder. Everyone knew Buffett, the great white shark, was virtually helpless to stop himself from acquiring these stocks. If he found $10 and spied a share of Blue Chip, Berkshire, or Diversified, he charged, grabbed, and threw the stock in the nearest drawer. After he and Munger had bought the first 25% of Wesco, Rickershauser had finally advised Buffett to buy stock only through formal, tender offers to avoid the appearance of impropriety. The complex cross-holdings that Buffett had created made it seem as though he was trying to hide something. Rickershauser looked at the crazy diagram and fretted, "There's got to be an indictment in there somewhere." He didn't think the SEC would have enough evidence to convict, but it would be awfully easy to accuse. In the greater sense, Munger was a two-bit player, his financial stake minute compared with Buffett's. He had been snared as a petty accomplice, but since Blue Chip was his territory, he was a principal in the Wesco saga and thus played a central role in the SEC's questioning. He admitted to Sideman, "We do have a very complicated set of business affairs, and I think we have learned, to our regret, that that may not be too smart. But we tried to keep all the balls in the air and properly sequenized with the other balls and handle them honorably. Despite the pair's protestations and the fact that it could find nothing wrong with the San Jose Waterworks or Source Capital deals, the SEC kept going. The tiger of a prosecutor now recommended to Sporkin that the SEC file charges against Buffett and Munger personally. He was unswayed by Buffett's and Munger's testimony and believed that they had intentionally quashed the Santa Barbara merger by overpaying for Wesco stock. He was unsympathetic to the who was harmed explanation for paying more for the stock and thought the pair was splitting hairs too fine in its explanations of events. Rickershauser wrote Sporkin directly. He pleaded with him not to prosecute Buffett and Munger, individuals who value their good names and reputations as their most priceless possessions, because many people, probably most people, assume evil conduct on the part of anyone civilly prosecuted by the commission. Even if Buffett and Munger consented to a settlement without admitting or denying the charges, merely filing them would cause terrible, irreversible damage, because the good reputation of the commission automatically and inexorably destroys the good reputation of the defendants. A giant strength should be used with great discretion, he urged. The risk from inadvertent oversights in business should not become so onerous that people who value their reputations are deterred from participation. He begged to save Buffett and Munger's reputations by offering to consent to an order on minor technical disclosure violations on behalf of Blue Chip only, as long as the consent decree did not name any individuals. The panic inside Buffett's mind can only be imagined. Within the office, he did his best to maintain an imperturbable facade so as not to alarm his office staff, any of whom might be interviewed by the SEC. Rickershauser worked like a stevedore to portray his clients as upstanding citizens from the perfect model families. He sent in biographies of Munger and Buffett to the SEC, stressing their charitable work, the many boards on which they served, Howard Buffett's tenure as a congressman, and the millions of dollars of taxes that Buffett had paid to the government since filing his first tax return at age 14. Buffett obviously had been grinding away at this document as if his life depended on it. Munger was resigned. If a policeman follows you down the road for 500 miles, he said to Buffett, you're going to get a ticket. Then Rickershauser made a further proffer to Sporkin, put delicately, the complex financial interests of Mr. Buffett and Mr. Munger have apparently raised the impression that compliance with various legal requirements is becoming difficult, he wrote, noting the pair had tried to comply with both the spirit and the letter of the law. They now wish to simplify their holdings as rapidly as they can. In their interviews, the SEC lawyers had already explored what simplifying would mean. Sometime in the future, it is certainly possible that we would merge Blue Chip with Berkshire, Buffett had responded to their question. But Blue Chip has a lot of legal problems, and until some of those are resolved, it might be hard to arrive at what we would feel reasonably sure would be a fair exchange ratio. If I had my preferences, it would be that someday they would be merged. So hopefully we would have more or less the same businesses we have now, but less complications. I don't really like these complications. It may look like I like these complications. I don't have a great staff to handle it all. It seemed fairly simple while we were doing it, he said, but not simple now. Asked by an SEC investigator if Buffett had contingency plans to simplify things, oh, does he ever, says Munger. He has about twice as big a contingency plan as before this investigation started. In considering the proffer, says Sporkin today, much depended on Rickershauser. He was one of those few lawyers that I've met in life that, whatever he told you, you could go to the bank on. Sporkin viewed Rickershauser as not only a brilliant lawyer, but truthful, straightforward, and upright, incapable of being disingenuous. Rickershauser told Sporkin that Buffett was going to be the greatest person that Wall Street has ever seen, and that he was the most decent, honorable person you would ever meet. Coming from almost anyone else, Sporkin would have dismissed this as rhetoric, but coming from Rickershauser, he took these statements to be both sincere and probably well-judged. Sporkin felt he had as great a duty to absolve as to convict. He thought that a prosecutor had to differentiate between a fundamentally honest person who had made a misstep and a crook. When it came to crooks, his job was to put them away. His view of Buffett and Munger was that they had certainly misstepped, but that they were not crooks. And so the giant tapped Blue Chip gently on the wrist. The company consented to an SEC finding in which it neither admitted nor denied that it failed to notify investors it was trying to bust the Santa Barbara merger in buying Wesco's stock, and that Blue Chip had artificially propped up Wesco's market price over the course of 3 weeks. Blue Chip promised never again to do what it had not admitted it had done. The consent decree named no individuals. The publicity over the event had been trivial and would fade. Buffett's and Munger's records and reputations stayed clean. 2 weeks later, the SEC named Buffett to a blue ribbon panel to study corporate disclosure practices. It was forgiveness and, above all, a fresh start.